United States is the only country in the world that sentences juveniles to life without parole.
We are not only paying the price for that in terms of the mass incarceration, but also the numbers of young people who were pushed into that system.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for November 26th, a look at the empathy gap between people behind bars and those in charge of sending them away. Also on the show, the big business of plastic manufacturing is taking a toll on public health in the United States.
The industry, our public officials feel like no one is going to speak out. This is open space for them to just come here and poison us. I'll die before I let them take my land and my life.
But we start with an initiative aimed at getting more empathy into our criminal justice system. Let's get going. This Monday, roughly 40 progressive prosecutors across the country signed a pledge to visit prisons, jails, and juvenile detention centers and committed to have their staffs make the visits as well. In large part, the initiative is attempting to close a major empathy gap. Advocates say prosecutors should see and visit the facilities in which the people they incarcerate are held. Closing that empathy gap was also one of the goals of last month's Justice Votes 2020 presidential town hall. The attendees of the town hall were formerly incarcerated people, their family members, and others who have been directly affected by our criminal justice system. But only three of the Democratic candidates actually showed up to the event. Senators Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and billionaire Tom Steyer.
Tens of thousands of stories of personal destruction that have been caused at the hands of a criminal justice system that is patently biased, patently racist, patently attacking the most vulnerable people in our country.
And so you can't do that 30,000 foot direct what goes on the ground. You have to start on the ground with the people most involved, because otherwise you're not going to get all the information and nuance you need to have fair policy.
I have visited many prisons. I know what has been going on in the system, which is why way back when, you know, I made a very conscious decision to become a prosecutor, knowing how broken and how unjust the criminal justice system of America can be.
Presidential candidate Julian Castro also met with incarcerated individuals at a jail in Washington, D.C. last month. But while some candidates are focusing on criminal justice in their campaigns, a true overhaul of the system will also require the cooperation of prosecutors, who play a key role in shaping the charges brought against defendants and the sentences that are ultimately handed down. With us now is Justin Juvenal, a reporter for The Washington Post covering criminal justice issues, and Miriam Krinsky, the executive director at Fair and Just Prosecution, the group leading this initiative. Justin, Miriam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us on.
Miriam, you are a former U.S. attorney. What was your own record visiting prisons?
So I really didn't avail myself of the opportunity and you know, found myself in the 80s and 90s caught in that mindset that didn't understand that humanity and that human face and the consequences of what we were doing. And it was only years later, when I spent 5 years working on an investigation of conditions in prisons and jails and spent quite a bit of time inside those prison walls, that I started to come to understand the value and the need and really the obligation of prosecutors to make that kind of journey themselves and to give a face to the consequences of the weighty decisions they make.
Miriam, you know, people who signed up for this initiative are mainly progressive prosecutors. And a lot of what we're talking about here is empathy or lack thereof for this population. Do you think that less progressive prosecutors, more conservative prosecutors, people who are perhaps a little more punitive, might also be interested in agreeing to visit prisons and jails?
I think so. And I think that we're really at the cusp of a new normal in the field of prosecution, where the views of communities that they've simply had enough with the tough on crime and failed practices of the past is starting to take hold, and where we are seeing more prosecutors around the country from parts large and small, from coast to coast, and from both sides of the political divide, rally around these sorts of principles and the notion that they have to take responsibility for the justice system and for the human consequences of the decisions that they make.
Justin, you've been covering this issue, and I'm wondering, we said there are about 40 prosecutors across the country who signed on to this initiative, but who are some of the standouts for you in terms of the wave of prosecutors who are leading this charge?
Well, one gentleman who's gotten a lot of attention recently is Chesa Boudin in San Francisco. He was just elected as the prosecutor there. Wesley Bell is the St. Louis County prosecutor. He gained traction and got elected in the wake of the shooting out there of Michael Brown. There's the Attorney General of Vermont. As Miriam Krinsky says, there's a really a cross-section of prosecutors from across the country, from all regions, and you have major city prosecutors, and you also have some small town prosecutors as well.
We're seeing, Justin, across the country, prosecutors who want to change the status quo, who we're labeling here at least as more progressive. Are they really able to implement their agendas, or are they facing resistance?
Well, they're able to implement their agendas in some cases, but they're also facing resistance. We've seen particularly police unions push back against some of these prosecutors. The race I just mentioned in San Francisco saw the police union out there dump hundreds of thousands of dollars into the campaign to try to defeat Chesa Boudin. They were ultimately unsuccessful, but there is increasingly strident and strong pushback against these prosecutors and their policies. A lot of police and more conservative folks feel that their policies will increase crime and make communities less safe.
Justin, 2020 presidential candidate Kamala Harris, who herself is a former prosecutor, has come under fire for that record and as attorney general in California. I want to play a little bit about what she had to say about why she chose to be a prosecutor over being a defense attorney during the presidential debate in October.
I made a decision to become a prosecutor for two reasons. One, I've always wanted to protect people and keep them safe. And second, I was born knowing about how this criminal justice system in America has worked in a way that has been informed by racial bias. And I could tell you extensively about the experiences I and my family members have personally had. But I made a decision that if I was going to have the ability to reform the system, I would try to do it from the inside.
Now, of course, Justin, Kamala Harris has come under criticism for her role as a prosecutor for more progressive voters of color in particular. Does what she say there mirror a lot of what progressive prosecutors today are saying, that they want to try and change things from the inside?
Yeah, that's actually sort of the philosophy of it. In fact, a lot of the people that you see coming forward to run as progressive prosecutors are former public defenders, former civil rights attorneys, who have decided to forego that line of work and actually redirect their energy towards, winning these elections and trying to change the system from the inside. I mean, the idea is that the prosecutor is one of the most powerful actors in the criminal justice system. They have great latitude on sentencing, on what charges to pursue, on whether to seek bail or do away with bail. So the idea is that they can have a great influence over the criminal justice system and a direct influence by taking these offices and implementing more progressive policies.
Miriam, for prosecutors who make a point of visiting prisons and jails before this initiative took off, or even, now that this initiative is being signed off on, what are the tangible changes that you're looking to see in terms of how they do their work? I mean, I guess, a big part of the question is this just a photo op to say we did it and we went in, behind the gates and we've seen what happened? Or is there really anything that prosecutors can get out of this that will change the way that they operate?
I think there's a huge amount that they can get from it. And I think, as you described it at the outset, the notion of that empathy gap really acknowledges that there's no substitute for the human face and the seeing firsthand the consequences of that decision to charge or not to charge, to seek a mandatory minimum, to put a young person into the adult system, really being able to have that human contact. And also, it's a manifestation, I think, these visits of a revisioning of their role, taking on and owning the responsibility for the conditions inside the places where they send people, starting to see the treatment that goes on for those who are struggling with substance use issues or have medical problems, understanding the life stories of individuals who have ended up making big mistakes, but shouldn't be defined forever by that worst mistake that they've made. And also starting to own the notion that these are individuals who are coming back to our community. And there's more that we have to be doing to prepare them for reentry and to not put them on the never-ending cycle in and out of the justice system that too many of them find themselves on. So I think that there are a huge number of ways in which these visits can be impactful and start as well to break down the longstanding culture in prosecutors' offices that have led to some of the patterns that we've seen and to the mass incarceration that so many of these new leaders seek to break down.
In terms of some of those patterns, I mean, are you expecting perhaps to get sentencing reform out of this, where the idea is, you know, we can't incarcerate somebody for 20 years in a cell that size? Are you looking to hope that prosecutors might advocate perhaps for more programming and rehabilitation services behind prison gates?
All of the above. And we've seen examples of that. We've seen Stephanie Morales in Virginia start to advocate and create reentry programming based on visits she's conducted. We've seen Dan Satterberg in Seattle advocate and take on the issue of needing to look for mechanisms for reviewing past decades-long sentences based on what he saw and his recognition and understanding that individuals don't have to be thrown away, that past choices that were made are not the choices for sentences we would make today. And by virtue of that, there's a responsibility for prosecutors to go back and reopen those doors and return people to the community if they no longer need to be sent to these facilities and kept there for decades on end.
Justin, one of the things that's emerging in this conversation is also the idea that some of these initiatives are bipartisan, at least in theory. Are you seeing a shift in the way politicians talk about sentencing, mass incarceration? I mean, we know President Trump signed the Bipartisan First Step Act into law late last year.
Yeah, there's actually been a real shift in the last several years. It's been a bipartisan shift. You've seen, Republicans come on board with some criminal justice reform, and they're making arguments for criminal justice reform from a conservative perspective. The cost of incarcerating people and incarcerating people in the numbers that we do in the United States has skyrocketed and blown budgets. So you see a lot of Republicans making arguments that we need to reduce the prison population as a means of streamlining government budgets. So, the First Step Act and other reforms that we've seen in recent years would not have come about if there wasn't a movement on both sides of the aisle.
Justin Juvenal is a reporter for The Washington Post who covers criminal justice issues. And Miriam Krinsky is the executive director at Fair and Just Prosecution. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
On September 28, 2016, in Townville, South Carolina, 14-year-old Jesse Osborne shot and killed his father. He then drove to Townville Elementary School, where he killed 6-year-old Jacob Hall and wounded 2 other victims. Earlier this month, Osborne, who's now 17, was sentenced as a juvenile to life without parole. The United States is the only country in the world that sentences juveniles to life in prison. United Nations, human rights groups, and many legal organizations, including the American Bar Association, have all called for an end to life without parole for children. According to the ACLU, there are approximately 2,570 inmates in the country who are currently serving life without parole sentences that they received as juveniles. According to the Washington Post, in the past 2 years, there have been 8 shootings at K-12 schools where an underage gunman killed someone, which means that more sentences like Osborne's could soon be handed down. Joining me now to talk about juvenile life without parole sentences is Marcia Levick, Chief Legal Officer and co-founder of the Juvenile Law Center. Thanks for being with us, Marcia.
Thank you.
It's a very complicated and thorny issue to unpack. Let's talk about who is receiving these sentences. What's the demographic breakdown of juveniles? Who are they?
The best data that we have suggests that probably about 40% of them are men and women of color, mostly African American. While they're not a majority of the individuals who have received that sentence, they are disproportionately represented, which is what we see across our justice system.
Given that, and given the fact that we also know that there are biases, sentencing biases that show up in courtrooms when it comes to defendants of color, is this conversation emerging now because many of the school shooters that we're seeing are white and male?
First, I want to say that issues about racism in the justice system aren't limited to sentencing. And I really think it's important for your listeners to appreciate that it starts at the beginning. So we do need to look at what happens at the arrest stage, what happens at charging, and ultimately what happens at sentencing. I think that the concern about school shootings is also a complicated issue because, as with each new school shooting, I think it raises not only questions about our justice system and how we respond to them, but obviously, of course, gun control. So it becomes a more complicated question, but it certainly has been a piece of the motivation, I think, for the very robust conversation we're having about our justice system right now.
Part of that conversation also involves criminal justice reform, which we know was essentially scuttled in the 1990s because of the Bill Clinton crime bill. Many of the programs that went into attempting to rehabilitate and correct offenders' behavior were disbanded in favor of more punitive measures. Is that part of the reason why this is emerging in the conversation now?
Absolutely, yes. And I think that we can look back now at what happened in the 1990s, the perpetuation at that time of the super predator myth, something that led to the treatment of the Central Park Five in the way that they were presumed guilty. And yes, we are not only paying the price for that in terms of the mass incarceration, but also the numbers of young people who were pushed into that system.
When we talk about the nature of a crime and how that plays into this, you mentioned that some of these were mandatory sentences, which is something else that's being discussed a lot when it comes to criminal justice reform. But are courts in general less sympathetic when it comes to school shooters? These are folks who generally, you know, are killing their child peers in many instances. We've seen shootings from elementary school through high school. Is there a sense that if it's not a mandatory sentence, that that's part of what goes into deciding these life sentences for juvenile offenders?
I think that we do have a history in this country of elevating victims who are young people. And certainly that includes the victims of school shooters. There are many states across the country that impose higher penalties where the victim is a child, child sexual abuse, for example. So I think that's a piece of it. We're in a difficult position with many school shootings because many of the school shooters are either killed or kill themselves. So that in research terms, the sample that we have is not ideal in trying to sort out what happens in those cases. And I do think that because mandatory sentencing was just abolished by the Supreme Court just about 7 or 8 years ago and really only made applicable to all of the states in the country just a few years ago, we're still sorting out how discretionary sentence, where that will lead in terms of how particular shooters with particular victims, how that will be addressed. I do want to add, though, that we certainly know from the death penalty research that has been done in terms of capital sentencing, and I suspect that some of this will play out for life without parole, for juvenile, for children as well, is that also the race of the victim matters. And so while we may not see the gross disproportionality in terms of more than half, for example, of individuals on death row being men or women of color, if the victim is white, that absolutely has been demonstrated to be a significant factor in sentencing. So that's something that we'll be looking for as well.
We're having a conversation today on our show about empathy in the criminal justice system. And I wonder where you see this headed, this issue in particular headed in the future, if whether there's any upcoming cases or laws that could really overhaul life without parole and really bring to light the question of, for example, if someone is not sentenced to life without parole, what then? Do we focus on rehabilitation, or are there some folks who are just not able to be rehabilitated?
I think we are seeing a shift, an increasing willingness to try to hold those individuals accountable, but in developmentally appropriate ways. And what I mean by that, of course, is recognizing that as teenagers and adolescents, they are different from you and me. They're not adults. We really need to continue to ask ourselves, what is the goal of our justice system? Part of it is certainly public safety, but it is also about rehabilitation. The vast majority of individuals who go into the justice system come home. And when they come home, we want them to come home in ways that they're prepared and that they're able to integrate back into their communities successfully. There will be some individuals who won't be able to do that. And I think the Supreme Court left open the possibility that there will be particular teenagers or adolescents who over time will simply never get to that point of demonstrating maturity, of showing rehabilitation. And they may not get out of prison. But I also think the court has made it clear that today in this country, it is really incumbent upon us to provide opportunities for release.
Marcia Levick is the chief legal officer and the co-founder of the Juvenile Law Center. Marcia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
From plastic bag bans to zero waste cities, plastic is becoming more and more unpopular these days. At least for consumers. For big oil companies, plastic is an increasingly important source of profit, and the expansion of fracking in the United States has paved the way for a renaissance in American plastics manufacturing. Petrochemical giants and companies like Shell and Exxon are investing tens of billions of dollars in plastics production and infrastructure as part of their strategy to ensure the fossil fuel market remains strong. More than 300 projects around the country are underway or newly completed. But the communities living near those plants are suffering. Sharon Levine, the director of Rise St. James, an organization formed to fight a plastic plant in Louisiana, testified before the U.S. House Subcommittee on Environment and Climate Change last week and asked her representative for a moratorium on the oil, gas, and petrochemical industry in her parish. We spoke to Levine about how she got involved in the fight and what effects it's having on her community.
One day when I was in my classroom teaching, my daughter called and told me that, Mama, the governor is at Roses celebrating. He's approving a $9.4 billion industry to come into St. James. I literally got sick. In my community, it's about 85% black, and most of us are poor. I think the industry or our public officials feel like no one is going to speak out. They don't think anyone will rock the boat. To me, it looks like this is open space for them to just come here and poison us because they know no one is going to speak up. And look, the years that went by, no one spoke up. I never dreamed in a million years that I would be doing something like this. I don't think this fight will ever die. I'll die before I let them take my land and my life.
In 2016, Levine was diagnosed with autoimmune hepatitis, and in the spring of this year, she found out she had aluminum in her body.
I didn't know, but before this happened, I didn't know the chemicals from these plants were causing us to be sick. I didn't know that. I thought me getting older, things happen in your body. That's what I thought in my mind. I never associated this with the chemicals that they were emitting in the air. I didn't know what kind of chemicals they were emitting. I didn't know what they were doing. All I know was industries in St. James.
But Levine isn't the only one in the area who's gotten sick. She says many of her neighbors have suffered from the contaminated air and water as well.
We have a funeral tomorrow. A good friend of mine, he died of cancer. My neighbor on both sides of where I live, both of them died of cancer. So many people are dying. So many people have asthma. So many children have to go to the doctor. My grandchildren, when they go outside and they stay outside for a long period of time, the skin have rashes on it. They have sinus problems. They have breathing problems. My little grandchildren have to stay to go to the doctor for something. There's always something.
We asked Zoe Carpenter, a contributing writer for The Nation, just how widespread this problem is.
Well, one of the things I've found is that it's mostly communities and communities of color who are hosting these types of polluting facilities. So there's a real environmental justice problem with the plastics industry. A lot of these new facilities are being planned in areas like Cancer Alley in Louisiana, as it's colloquially known. And for decades, this is a stretch along the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and New Orleans that has a incredibly high concentration of petrochemical facilities. And many residents have for years reported higher rates of cancer and other illnesses that they think are related to these facilities. So this plastics boom is going to bring yet more of these facilities to areas that already have serious air and water quality issues. But it's also going to affect new communities.
What happens after plastic is produced? How does plastic production affect not just the environment, but also communities?
It affects communities all along the chain of production. The pollution concerns range from the very local to the global.
Stories like the one we just heard in Louisiana show just how dangerous it can be to live in direct proximity to a plastics manufacturer. But the range of negative health outcomes extends far beyond any single location.
You have communities that live near wellheads, so around fracking operations that bear the brunt of pollution from those operations. And then you have communities who live near the refining facilities and the cracker facilities, who are then subject to air pollution from those facilities. And then you have the communities that live further down the chain who have the actual plastic waste or the incinerators that burn plastic waste in their communities. So one of the things that I was interested in my reporting are plans to create what would essentially be a brand new petrochemical corridor along the Ohio River Valley in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. So not only is this plastics expansion going to affect areas that already bear a heavy burden of industry, but it's going to bring those same problems potentially to new parts of the country.
What role, if any, has Congress played in all of this? Have they taken any action so far to protect communities living near these plants?
Well, currently the momentum at the federal level is pretty pro this plastics expansion. In particular, some members of Congress from that Ohio River Valley region and members of the Trump administration are very supportive of bringing new plastics facilities to the area because they see it as a source of economic growth and aren't concerned about the environmental implications.
Well, and a lot of these conversations are also framed around the debate about jobs and resources. Can you talk a little bit about how plastic production is being talked about in regards to that debate in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania? I mean, these are states that have seen a gutting of their manufacturing bases. Is it being positioned as a job generator?
Yes, absolutely. And the petrochemical industry itself uses that in a lot of its talking points when it speaks about this new renaissance. And it's true that many of these areas where the plastics expansion is happening are economically struggling areas. But many people have pointed out to me in my reporting that this is really the same old story where these places have always kind of been in the grip of the boom and bust cycle that follows extractive industries, whether it was coal or steel or oil. That has never been a particularly secure economic future, as we've seen with the booms and busts over decades.
People are talking about not using plastics, including everything from plastic straws to single-use plastics to no longer using plastic water bottles and disposable plastics. Aren't these companies going against the trend? I mean, how is it that they're investing when the consumer trends, at least in some parts of the country, seem to be pointing in the opposite direction?
Well, I think consumer trends and public awareness are a bit different. And it is true that I think there's more awareness of the need to stop using single-use plastics. But that doesn't mean that people are able to do that on a scale big enough to actually change the system at this point. I think the industry is fighting a lot of the local efforts to stop the use of single-use plastic bags, for example. And so I think there's a big power asymmetry here between the money and the political clout that industry has and individual consumer actions on the other hand. And so I think what activists who are working on this issue want is for the industry to have to take more responsibility for its products. So whether that's by some kind of fee or tax that would then help pay for the cleanup and the cost of recycling, whether that's bans on single-use plastics, there are a lot of ways to approach that. But the fact of the matter is that right now, only about 9% of plastic gets recycled at best. And so we have a problem both with the production of single-use plastics and with the fact that even recyclable plastics aren't getting recycled. So it's a pretty huge systemic problem that the industry would like us to think can be tackled by all of us doing a better job cleaning up our trash.
And so that's part of what you said earlier with their marketing pitches, right, to consumers, whereas we should be recycling. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
You know, we've seen a lot of attention even from the industry on trash pickup and recycling, and they'd like us to focus on that and ignore the fact that what they're doing is pumping a lot more plastic into a system that already can't keep up with the amount that's in the environment. But the fact is, recycling is not economically viable in many places, including in the U.S. Most of our plastic waste historically was shipped to China. China no longer accepts that. And so the U.S. itself has a huge problem with products not getting recycled. So recycling right now is not really a viable option to fix this problem. And so I think what many activists and academics and others who are working on this would like to see is curtailing the production itself and then, of course, increasing the recycling capacity. But the metaphor I use is that focusing just on recycling is like trying to bail out a bathtub with a teaspoon while the tap is on full blast. There's just too much plastic being produced.
So, Zoe, is there any cause for optimism here? Is there any movement towards solutions?
Well, I think public awareness is good news. And there are lots of local efforts underway in the U.S. and elsewhere. I think what we're seeing now from the grassroots level is really interesting, where communities that previously fought somewhat disparate struggles against various aspects of the supply chain have now united in the Break Free from Plastics movement and in other efforts. And they're linking these struggles around the globe from communities who are trying to protect themselves from the local pollution from fracking to communities of recyclers living overseas. They now see themselves as part of one movement that's trying to stop this problem of plastic waste. And so I think that is the good news, that there is this somewhat new and rapidly growing movement to both raise awareness and change policy.
Zoe Carpenter is a contributing writer for The Nation. Zoe, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.